Welcome to the Gravity Podcast, where we host conversations on developing a Christian spirituality rooted in love that fosters resilient faith in everyday life. Hello, everyone. Welcome to the Gravity Commons Podcast. It's good to be recording this, knowing that you'll be listening to it.
That's right.
Yes. I was going to say it's good to be together, but Christy, it's just you and me.
It's just us.
Together. And even that, you know, is like we're...
thousands of miles away.
Yeah, two time zones away from each other, but somehow, looking at each other's... at least a representation of each other's faces and hearing a digital representation of each other's voices.
Yep.
And it allows us to have a conversation across the miles. Every once in a while, listener, you may be tired of me saying this, but every once in a while, I marvel at this.
Yeah.
It's remarkable.
Well, you can probably hear my dog eating her breakfast right in the back. Yeah. She's so happy.
So happy.
I do think it's kind of interesting because do you remember when Marco Polo became like new? And I remember telling a friend like we should do this instead of voice text each other. And she was like, mm-hmm. You mean record a video of yourself talking? And like, that's not intimate. And I was like, it's better than not doing it. So it's like, to me, it's good.
Yeah. It doesn't replace face-to-face communication. It doesn't replace the necessity. I think COVID showed us this, right? Where it doesn't replace the necessity of being in a room with others. Like that's really crucial. Like Zoom could never replace. I mean, everybody got so alienated, lonely, depressed, even though we were on Zoom calls all day. There's something about it, but there still is something remarkable about being able to have a conversation where I can talk in my office here in my house, you can talk in your kitchen in your house, and I can hear you.
Yeah. I'm thankful for technology in that way.
Yeah. And we can record it, post it on the internet, and listener, you can download it and listen to it after the fact. And that's also a form of connection in a way, you know, I guess it's an extension of the technology of books, which has been around for a long time, but that's also a way of sort of extending thought into time and space so that others can interact with it.
Well, talking about books, are you reading any books? Are there any like...
No, I've stopped reading books.
You're like, forget it. No way.
Forget it. I'm done. Actually, I actually just did see an article in The Atlantic that... talked about the stats around like people's actual reading of actual books, and it's pretty dismal. I mean, the title of the article was "The End of Reading is Here."
Oh my goodness, that's crazy!
Isn't that crazy?
I do think
it's true
that most books could just be an article. Let's be honest.
That is true.
We could consolidate.
Yeah.
But
it might be part of the problem. But also, like the number of people. I can't remember the stats off the top of my head, but I think it was in 2022, more than half of people that responded to this survey read zero books of any kind in the last year.
Really?
And yes. And that stat is going severely down. I think it was something, I don't want to misrepresent the stats, but because I don't have the article in front of me. But yeah, people are they're still reading text. They're reading little snippets. They're reading snippets on Twitter or Reddit or, you know, on Instagram. They're reading these tiny little snippets of text, but the literacy required to read a long-form book, follow an argument, follow a story is declining rapidly. And they connect that with people's ability to think and people's ability to sort of think constructively, to think critically about ideas. And so anyway, I actually do feel it's one of the things that alarms me most right now, just because I think post-literate people are very easy to manipulate.
Well, if I'm being
critically about the ideas that are coming to you. Yeah, go ahead.
If I'm being honest, if somebody sends me a long email, or even a long text that is like, you know, like when you get like, you have to scroll to actually read the whole entire text. Uh-huh. I'm like, oh, I think I'll do that later.
Yeah. Well, sure. There's a sense in which the medium of texting has trained us to expect, you know, short texts. And I really cannot read like long form books. I really cannot read them. Like I can do an e-reader, like a Kindle e-reader, but I can't, like, if you send me your book as a PDF, that's going to be really hard for me to just read on my computer screen or on my phone. I cannot do it.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
So I need a codex, you know, I need the physical
the pages.
Book.
Yeah.
Yeah. Or I need, like an e-reader, but I even prefer, I've stopped using my e-reader even because I don't know. I like the feeling of making progress through a book.
Sure. You
know, I can look at where the bookmark is and get a feel for, oh, okay, here's where I'm at in this book. I can flip back pretty easily to a previous page and find like a highlight. Whereas with an e-reader, I can't do that.
Yeah.
Easily. You know, I have to, it's all digital. It's virtual. It doesn't feel like it's there.
Well, in a funny sequence of things, we're talking about books and reading and all this kind of stuff, but I just this week had a dream about having a conversation with guests that were at my house about books that I was reading. And I was telling them that I was reading all these different, like, oh, I read this like Jewish author. And then I read this and like in my dream, I was this very smart person who was reading all these like amazing books. And it just wasn't true. I woke up and nope, that's not really me.
Maybe, what do you think that dream says though?
Maybe I'm interested in things. I don't know. Maybe, listener, maybe have a book to suggest to me to read and then I need to read. I don't know.
Yeah.
It was weird.
You know, my wife is at the end of her schooling to become a licensed mental health counselor.
Yeah.
And the last course that she took before she's working on her capstone now, but the last course that she took was on dreams.
Really?
Like dream interpretation. Yeah, like Jungian dream interpretation. And she said it was utterly fascinating. And I don't know, it's a really interesting practice that I really didn't know much about. But it'd be interesting to analyze your dream.
Right.
I don't really know how to do it, but.
No. I'm just believing there's lots of interests I have and I don't know.
Yeah.
I have this desire to learn things, which is probably true, but just funny that I woke up and was like, I don't even know any, like they weren't real books, you know, in my dream.
Yeah. Well, anyway, I know there's symbols and that kind of thing that they talk about. But one of the things that stuck with me from what Deb told me about that course was that dreams don't give us answers. They give us questions.
Ooh.
And so oftentimes dreams are a helpful way for us to get at questions that we might be asking that are beneath the level of our consciousness.
Hmm.
You know, they sort of emerge from the depths of our psyches when our guard is down, so to speak, when we're asleep. And if we can look at those things and say, I wonder what this says about the questions I'm asking right now or the desires that I have that maybe I'm not allowing myself to feel or know. While I'm awake, and maybe I could learn something.
Well, talking about learning something.
Okay, good. I like that transition. That was good.
We had a really good conversation that I probably could have talked about for a long time, like neuroscience and attachment and intimacy with God and like those types of things. I'd struggled when I was getting my doctorate, what to write my whole dissertation on. And all of those things were kind of coming to a point. So the conversation that we are going to share today kind of merges all of those things. Along with church mothers and fathers and Julian of Norwich. And so.
Yeah. We're talking with Susan Carson today. We've talked with her in the past about maybe one of her other books. But I really appreciated this book and this conversation because I have sort of long been fascinated by the, I guess the similarities that I see. I don't do a ton of reading in neuroscience, but the stuff that I have seen and the stuff that I know, it really is interestingly, it overlaps really interestingly with a lot of what the ancient church, a lot of what like mystical theologians have been saying for, you know, hundreds of years. And so it's really interesting to kind of see a book that Susan wrote here that sort of merges those two things in a very practical way, because this book is really about healing, and it's about, you know, healing our trauma, healing our alienation, and kind of looking at insights from both Julian of Norwich and neuroscience to do that. So the book is called A Canonic Way of Contemplative Healing, Julian of Norwich, Neuroscience and the Centrality of Safety in Healing Our Trauma. And Susan Carson is the founder and executive director of Roots and Branches, which is a nonprofit in Cincinnati, Ohio, offering spiritual direction and contemplative healing. Susan is a certified spiritual director. She's an author, speaker, and the host of the Rooted Intentionally podcast. She holds a master's in theology and culture from St. Stephen's University. You can interact with her more and learn more about her at her website, which is just susancarson.net. Let's get into this conversation.
Susan Carson, welcome back to the Gravity Commons podcast.
Thank you. Gosh, it's so good to be here. Thanks for the invite to have a return visit.
Yeah. Well, it's good to see you again and good to hear from you about spiritual direction. You said something in the intro of your book that caught my attention and I wanted to hear more about it. So now we have you here. You're captive. Yeah. And so we get to ask you questions. But you describe in like a paragraph, you describe a shift in your spiritual direction. We could call it philosophy, right? How your practice went from one way of doing spiritual direction early on to a different kind of spiritual direction now. And I wonder if you could name how it's different, you know, draw some distinctions for us or differentiation. Sure. And then how did you come to make those changes? Was it intentional? Was it organic? Were there like key moments where you had realizations? Would love to hear about that journey.
Yeah, thanks. It was definitely a journey over time. And I think over that period of about 10 to 12 years of just being in listening space with people, spiritual direction kinds of space with people. And as my faith, my theology was evolving in that same period, the two, I can't really separate the two, because what I was noticing with people informed the way that my faith was kind of shifting and evolving. But I would also say the way my faith and theology were shifting and evolving was, I'm sure, informing the way I was interacting with people. So I'll say more about that. I think what I started to notice as I was just had the honor of being with people in spiritual direction kind of space was that when we would leave space, when I would leave space for somebody to like take a beat and listen to their own heart and then listen to God, what might God have to have you to know about that? Jesus never interacted with people the way my theology sort of said we should interact with people. So I would say I started with much more of a top down, I'm the person in the room who knows what needs to happen, sort of born out of a view of God and people of we're sort of depraved and we can't really trust our hearts. So you probably need me to help you figure this out. And there might be some specific things that you need to do that I need to lead you through that will help you get some more freedom or insight or understanding in your life. And I wouldn't say that any of those things in and of themselves were bad, but it was a very me-driven approach. And what I noticed as I was opening space with people, particularly in spaces of trauma, to really meet with Jesus in that space, that he really wanted to just be with people and in their suffering and speak truth and love to them in the kindest ways. He didn't seem to show up with a, you need to know how wicked your heart is. And it was really just loving connection in that space. And I just started to wonder over time, like, maybe that's the point. Like, what if I did less? And what if I just made more space for that? Mm. So it was sort of a big experiment over time, really, of sort of peeling back. Like, what if there's more space for quiet? What if I just do more listening as reflecting? Trying as a spiritual director to also ask good, helpful questions, but really trusting the person in the chair across from me to know, like, if I leave them space, their truest self and Christ in them together know way better than I do what they need. They have the wisdom. And so I become more of a follower on their journey as opposed to a leader, if that makes sense.
It makes a lot of sense. I bet Ben has some thoughts about this. You know, he's in spiritual direction school right now and learning all about this stuff. But I'm, you know, Bradley Jerzak, who's been on our show several times, wrote the foreword to your book. Mm-hmm. It seems like you were in a program with him as well. That was the genesis of this book. And several years ago, I'm tempted to say many, but my memory is so bad that everything seems like many years ago. Several years ago, Bradley said almost the exact same thing to us on this podcast about what changed his theology. And Ben, I think you were there. Christy, I can't remember if you were there, but he talked about how he was doing some counseling with people who had done the worst crimes, like against children, just awful, awful things. And when he sat with them and asked them the same kind of question you're talking about, Susan, what does Jesus want you to know? He was blown away by the amount of compassion that Christ showed these just what he considered to be the worst of sinners. And it, like, opened his heart. Ben, do you remember that?
I do. The vague outline of it as you're saying it. And yeah, I remember it was very, I don't remember the contours of it, though, fully, but that, I think that was the outline. Go ahead, Susan.
No, just that Bradley and I have compared notes on that, that separately we had very much the same journey in this, and just seeing the kindness of God and the beauty of the human soul, it kind of shifted everything for me.
Yeah, it's like the program that I've been actually completed recently. But that names one of the main learnings for me, was just do less, in a sense. And there is a, like, I did notice over the 2 years, just an increased sense of, what feels to me like emptiness that I come with. I used to have a lot of, I don't know, resources would come to mind, and exercises, and, you know, theology. I love theology, you know, and that would come to mind. And I'd end up doing too much. And I find now that I mostly feel empty and I'm more comfortable with silence, and more seems to happen. It's, which is ironic. It's like, I went to school and learned that I'm doing too much. I went to school and learned how to do less. Right?
Isn't it great?
It is great. It's a big relief in one sense, and a little frustrating in another sense, right? It's like my project for being important, at least for me anyway. That was part of the goodness of it for me. Anyway, but it sounds like you've been in that kind of school for a while. And I do just want to commend you for going on that journey. You know, I think there's a lot of people that get locked into the initial way that they do ministry, and, you know, they become a professional, and they've got a job to do and they don't know how to do it. And, you know,
yeah,
there's a comfort in that. I understand that, but, I commend you for going on this, journey of kind of uncertainty and leaning in.
Yeah. Thanks.
One of the things, that I've learned, over the last several years that I didn't know early on in ministry, it sounds like you did the same kind of learning based on your book, was about trauma, how trauma plays a role in our lives. I wonder if you can share a bit about what, in what ways can spiritual directors like yourself treat trauma with dignity and compassion? How does that play into some of the learning that you've done over the last few years?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think maybe we'll talk about safety and what does it mean to create a safe space? Because for me, it became much more about, in doing less, I'm actually creating a space and being more of a safe presence and person for the people that I'm sitting with. So safety is, I mean, trauma, right? We experience trauma when we're overwhelmed by a circumstance that we don't have the ability to react to, get out of, escape from. And it's almost always experienced alone.
Yeah.
So it embeds in our body and our nervous systems and our brains. That way it becomes, in a sense, that part of us that, traumatized part of us is alienated from ourselves, from God, from other people. It's in hiding because it's not safe to come back out. And it probably won't come back out. It probably won't emerge for healing in a space that doesn't feel safe. So the best way I can help create safe space for them as a safe person is to come with, first of all, enough of my own maybe healing and the journey that I have an inner stability that I can sit with them and not be triggered or overwhelmed as their suffering and trauma emerges. So again, I'm not the expert. Henry Nouwen talks about us as wounded healers, right? So we know our wounds and we know our own journey. And then I think it has been at the emptying of myself, being willing to hold silence, being willing to empty myself of my own words and my own need to speak and interject something. Being willing to suspend my opinions or thoughts about what they need in that moment. Certainly not bringing any kind of shame or judgment into the room. It has to be shame-free space. And not bringing any sense of, here are the three easy steps to you dealing with your trauma right now. So as I come in as hopefully a regulated, emptied sort of presence, the people I sit with can actually experience that sense of safety, but also begin to co-regulate with me, even with my nervous system, which I think is the coolest thing ever that we're made. We're made to be together like this, to be able to co-regulate with one another And then if we think about meeting with Jesus, maybe we can even co-regulate with God. Like, that's kind of cool.
Yeah.
And innately healing for our trauma, right? To bring those disconnected, alienated, hiding parts out in the open so they can experience healing, connection, in love, in a loving presence. That's where the healing starts to happen.
Yeah. Listener, as you may know, we are an entirely listener and participant supported podcast and organization. We decided to stop taking ad money a little while back. So part of what you might be interested in is how you can support us, how you can be involved in more of what we do. We're not just a podcast, but we have a community, an online community called the Gravity Community, and there's all kinds of good stuff that happens there.
Yeah, if you want to go from just listening to a podcast to actually participating in a community, you can join the book club, you can join classes that we offer. In fact, right now you guys are teaching stuff. And so how do they do that? How do they sign up? How do they get involved, Matt?
Yeah, you go to gravitycommons.com/reconstructing. Is that right, Ben? Did I do that right? No. gravitycommons.com/community. Ben knows the address better than I
community.
Do. No, it's community. But also reconstructing can get you there too. But yeah, we're doing a Sermon on the Mount class right now that Ben and I are taking turn teaching. Probably tag teaming is a better way to say that. And it's a lot of fun because I think we're dealing with how do we follow Jesus from, you know, the center and the ground of love, and how do we listen to Jesus's like teaching on the law, primarily centered on love. So that class will go through the next few weeks, and then we'll do another one. And if you join, you get access to all past classes and all past book clubs.
Yep. Yeah, we record each of these and we post them in there, and they're just freely available to anybody who joins the community. And part of the reason that we can offer that for free is that some people who are able to do so can they purchase a supporting membership, which is $25 a month in the community. And there's other ways to be involved and other ways to give. Sometimes when we offer a new class, people will kind of give a donation for that class, for their participation in that class or in that book club. But to get all the goodness and to see what all is involved, go to gravitycommons.com/community. Again, it's free to join, and you can just check things out there and get involved as you like. I mean, this name's, again, I think one of my main learnings over the last couple of years of kind of leaning into spiritual direction is I think I had a narrative in my head that if I was silent and if I wasn't saying anything, then I wasn't doing anything, right? And there was this kind of anxiety to fix or to solve or to give some steps or to, you know, give an assignment or something like that. Yeah. But it was a really big paradigm and an important paradigm shift to realize just what you're saying, that no, being there is doing something. Listening is doing something.
Yes.
And the fact that you're listening without judgment, the fact that you're listening with, you know, acceptance, the fact that you are, you know, co-regulating with someone, well, that's doing a lot. And maybe that's doing better work than I could do with my words anyway. So,
yeah, that's been my experience, just seeing it over and over again. Mm-hmm. It's like, why would I continue to insert myself in this very unhelpful way?
I know. It's very humbling.
Yeah.
Well, Susan, you discuss individual and communal trauma in your book, and I've heard you say creating a safe space, creating safety, giving space for people to listen to their bodies, to listen to they know themselves better than we know them, right?
Yes.
But I wonder if you could briefly share how trauma actually gets healed. And how do we recover from the wounding of trauma?
Yeah, that's a good question. And it's probably more than I'm going to say right now.
Sure. They should read your book.
And probably more than my book. But yeah, so trauma gets embedded in our bodies and our brains in this isolating kind of way, as in memories. So in safety, a memory can emerge, a place of trauma that we experienced. And the very cool thing is, as we are able to bring that memory out of isolation into relationship, that memory changes. Like, that memory is no longer an isolated, traumatized memory. So every time we can pull a memory out of the filing cabinet of our brain, if we want to think of it that way, it's refiled differently. So as we, in safe space, as we encounter face-to-face, that face-to-face embodied connection is central because our trauma is embodied. So we're bringing our isolated embodied experience into relational embodied experience with co-suffering love, with love that is with us. We're no longer alone. That love is with us in our suffering. And in that process, over time, not in a minute usually, not in a session, but over time, that trauma is healed. And so all the things that triggered us before, those triggers are diminishing and diminishing and diminishing until we're able to live more consistently from that healed kind of space.
Sign me up. Take all my money, Susan. No, all jokes aside. Yeah, humor is a trauma response, if you didn't know that about me yet. Obviously, Julia Norwich, who you talk about in this book, had no DSM-5 categorization for what we call trauma today, right? Mm-hmm. And you interact with her divine revelations in your book. Mm-hmm. But you find in her wisdom for how to reckon with and heal our trauma. Can you share a bit about how you made those connections? And particularly, you mentioned co-suffering love, and you talk about kenosis a lot too. Can you share about how you came to find in her a resource, an ancient resource for dealing with a modern pathology?
Yeah, I've come to love her. She's a bit of a companion for me now. And so Julian comes sort of into her experience of God through a very full-bodied, she thought she was on her deathbed, experience of a face-to-face experience of Christ on the cross, right? Christ emptying himself on the cross into death. And she has an experience of that with him in the very mystical kind of way that mystics do these things. And then spends the next 20 plus years of her life basically contemplating, sitting with God in her, it would have been called an anchorage or a cell. And she's having conversations with God, understanding from God of what this revelation of Christ on the cross meant. And one of the things she writes over and over and over again is seek into the beholding, this beholding for Julian was central, not just in her experience, but she would say it should be central in ours. And by beholding, yes, she meant seeing, right? Contemplating, gazing on Christ, listening to God. But she also, in that word, beholden, is that sense of being held by God and that experience of being held by God. And she's probably, well, she's probably most famous for a couple things, but one of them is her image of the hazelnut-like object that she sees in the hand. And that hazelnut-like object is, she says, everything. And the hand is the hand of God. And everything that is, ever was, or will be is held safely, she says, in the hand of God. And so in that, in her contemplation, in her gazing, in her face-to-face beholding, there she finds our becoming, that we are becoming our truest self, the self that we are created in Christ. As we are in Christ and Christ is in us, all held in the goodness and love of God, that this is what's truest about us. And as we contemplate that, gaze upon that, interact with God in that place, in that safety of being held and of beholding, we are changed and transformed. And yeah, she didn't have trauma vocabulary, but if you dive in, and I think in terms of mystics, I think she's one of the more accessible ones. Even the way she talks about sin and beauty, there's no blame for her in sin. It's just what happens to us, in the same way that trauma is kind of what happens to us as humans, right? Nobody, none of us emerges unscathed in this life. So it becomes this beautiful picture of we're all on this journey of becoming who we already are, in relationship, beholding love, beholding God.
Yeah. Well, like Matt said, sign me up. It sounds good. Maybe a final piece of the book that's even in the title of the book is the kind of the neuroscience piece, kind of bringing together the healing of trauma and some of the you know, what you're learning in spiritual direction and some of what the mystics seem to have known for a long time. But you also, you know, deal with kind of what we're discovering about neuroscience, how the brain, the body work, all of that kind of thing. And I think, you know, Christians over the years, this is getting probably better than it used to be, but Christians over the years have had a little bit of a suspicious relationship with science, sort of assuming that science posed an obstacle to their faith, or, you know, science was trying to explain God away, or, you know, something like that. But in your book, you talk about that, you know, the fact that neuroscience actually informs and supports the work that you do as a spiritual director. So I wonder if you can just talk about that for a bit, how those things for you are not competing, but complementing one another.
Yeah, and even confirming. I mean, I love it when neuroscience discovers things and names things that mystics or early church fathers and mothers wrote about hundreds and thousands of years ago. How beautiful is that? So in the book, I dive into the aspect of neuroscience around our vagus nerve, this nerve that runs from our brain through our whole body, that its function is to scan all the time. It's scanning for safety. Are we safe? Are we safe? And if we're not, it's giving us, it's telling our bodies, you're not safe. Go into your fight, flee, freeze, do something, because you're not safe. And so as that nerve, as we're in a regulated, right, state within ourselves and with other people, that nerve is actually attached to our eyes, our ears, our voice, our mouth. Like, there's a difference. I can't remember who I quoted in the book who said you can't fake a vagus kind of face. You can't fake it. You can't fake the tone of voice. It's actually becoming.
Interesting.
As our systems are regulated, as that vagus nerve is calm and not in fight or flight or agitated or maybe carrying less trauma than it did a year or two or three ago, that we are actually different. We are with people in a different way. And that person sitting across from me can see it and sense it in my eyes, in the tone of my voice, in my mouth. It's different for me in the way that I'm even hearing them or experiencing them. So it's like we're wired for this. And it becomes at that point just about a way of being, the way that we are being as humans together. Yeah. And it's all embodied. It's all going on in our bodies.
Yeah.
I could nerd on this for a long time.
Right. Like
the neuroscience piece in our brains and our bodies and all of it, it's fascinating to me. But I also know that we're kind of close to time. So I'm wondering if I can ask one final question. And if you could just address, how do we approach those of us who have religious trauma, where God himself is triggering for us? Mm-hmm. How can we sit in the presence of God when our bodies are communicating to us God's presence is dangerous because of things that have happened in the past?
Yeah, that's a great, great question. And I do think so much of this, particularly in terms of spiritual trauma, is about healing our image of God.
Yeah, right? Absolutely.
How we see God and how we believe God sees us. but I think that's where the human-to-human connection is so important, because I may not be in a place yet where I can feel safe connecting with God in any way at all. And actually, if we have time, maybe I'll share a cool story about that. But
go for it. We have time.
Yeah. So I was meeting with this young woman who had been assaulted by her youth pastor. And so God, Jesus, all of it was Jesus as a male presence was not okay. So I've done a lot of listening at this point, right? Just a lot of reflective listening. And here's a little tip. It's not in the book and it's just by observation, but I've really come to believe that if you just listen well to somebody, just reflectively listen well around the 20-minute mark, they're going to have some kind of insight or make some kind of connection or know something that they didn't know that they knew. So lots of listening, which is healing. Then I'm like, well, would you be okay seeing if we can just, maybe there's a safe space where you could be imaginatively today that might be healing? And she was open for it. So just got quiet and she sort of found herself imaginatively in her grandmother's backyard as a little girl. And she finds herself, there was a tree swing in her grandma's backyard. So she's like, I'm swinging on the tree swing, which I'm thinking is cool as I'm watching this, because swings regulate our nervous system, right? She's like, I can feel myself swinging. I'm like, that's cool. And I'm like, well, what if we just asked how God might be present with you in any way? She was game. She said, okay. And then she was like, oh, God is the wind pushing the swing. I'm like, oh. In a million years, I could never come up with this, right? Mm-hmm. And she's having this amazing, beautiful connection with God in the swing, with the wind. And we didn't make it mean any more than that that day, because that was what was for that day. And it was beautiful. So, yeah, I'm not sure I'm talking any more about the question that you actually asked about
it. No, I mean, I think in that story, it's correcting a view of God and for her. And I think we all need that more and more, but especially those of us who have had spiritual trauma. So
yes, I think you did answer. And I would add, thanks, just that me as a human being with her, being to the extent that I can be on any given day at any given moment, the presence of God, right? Christ is in all of us, so we can be this for each other. And so she couldn't connect with God, and yet somehow in safe space with me, she was able to take that step back towards God and find a way of experiencing and connecting with God that felt safe and loving and healing for her.
Yeah, Susan, I appreciate that story. I know every person that comes to Spiritual Direction with you, they're precious, their stories are theirs, and I appreciate you sharing that in a way that I think honors that young woman. Mm-hmm.
Listener, if you are looking for ways to get more deeply involved in what we do at Gravity and at the same time support the work that we're doing, I might invite you to think about Spiritual Direction.
Yeah, Thursdays are one of my favorite days because Thursday I meet with my friend Courtney for Spiritual Direction, and it's a conversation that we have an hour long, and we talk about where are you noticing God's activity in your life, and we do that together.
Well, that sounds great. Ben, could you give us a definition? What do you think spiritual direction is?
I'm actually finishing up school for spiritual direction. And that was one of the assignments, was to kind of write out your own version of it. Here's what mine is. Spiritual direction is a process of prayerful conversation that facilitates growing awareness of God's presence and involvement in your ordinary life. That invites you deeper into surrender to God's love and a fuller participation in the life that God shares with us. So yeah, if you're interested, go to gravitycommons.com/direction and obviously reach out. If you have any questions about that, you can email us at podcast@gravitycommons.com.
I just want to clock for our listeners, like, you know, Ben and I wrote a book where we talked about God's always present and at work. Mm-hmm. And obviously this is one of the central dynamics that we think is so helpful about learning to trust that. Mm-hmm. You know, Christy's led lots of cohorts, and I know that she has taught that stuff for years and practiced that for years. But I'm reminded again that one of the things that interferes with my ability to embody that with people is just my own anxiety, my own wanting to produce results, secure outcomes, not look foolish, have something wise to say, get people to do what I want. And sometimes it's, you know, all those things maybe aren't necessarily benevolent, but sometimes it's a benevolent thing. I want desperately for you to be able to be with God and not hurt you. How do I manufacture that result? You know, that's not the cognitive discursive thought, but that there's an anxiety for wanting to make this happen. Yeah. And I think I'm coming back again to remember as a gift of your work to me that, there's a ruthless, fierce trust at the core of our connection with God that is ultimately and thoroughly just surrender. Mm. And you know, I know Susan, that you and I, we do that imperfectly. But part of the gift of, it sounds like, your work and your book is having just enough faith, just enough times to leverage that trust on someone else's behalf. You know?
Yeah. And
I think that's a beautiful gift. Delighted that you were able to join us today. Just thank you for your continued growth and work and for running it all down so we can benefit too.
Thank you. Thank you guys so much. So good to be with you today. And I'm so grateful for all the good work you guys are doing in the world. Thank you.
The book again is A Kenotic Way, A Contemplative Healing, Julian of Norwich, Neuroscience and the Centrality of Safety and Healing Trauma. Bless you, Susan.
You guys, I could talk about that for a while because I think it's so deeply important for us to understand neuroscience and the vagus nerve and our nervous system and how understanding that can actually give us wisdom to understanding how to regulate ourselves so that we can actually be compassionately curious and dive into what is going on in our lives to learn from it.
Yeah.
Do you guys experience that?
Yes.
Yes, I do. Let me think about it. Mm-hmm. I got confused about experience what? I was like, wait, what is it?
No, I was just telling Ben today, I made this connection between procrastinating and my body experiencing something as a threat or danger.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
That sometimes when I'm avoiding a task, it's because my body, I'm not conscious of this, right? So there's no conscious story, but I'm coming to realize that when I avoid a task that is mundane or banal or it should be easy to do, that there's some kind of signal my body's giving my brain that it's a threat, that there's danger here.
Yeah.
That you don't want to do this because it'll cost you something and we don't want to pay that cost.
That's right.
Yeah. And if I can share for you, Matt went on to say.
Oh, all right.
I wanted to share this because this has been helpful for me. But you also talked about how sometimes you can just reframe it for yourself. Like once you realize consciously that you're like, oh, I'm avoiding this because it feels dangerous to me. And sometimes you can just reframe it and just sort of say, oh, but it's not dangerous, is it? It's just an email, you know, or whatever it might be. Or sometimes for me, so one of the examples that I can maybe give is like, this is the stuff I typically procrastinate about are projects where I don't feel quite certain I know what I'm doing yet, or it's a project where I feel like I don't really know what all the pieces are of this. And so like leaning into it triggers some kind of like the danger in it for me feels like the danger of one of my life messages that's not good, like the lies that has run my life is just that I have to show up useful, competent, helpful. And if I don't, my belonging is at stake. People are going to want to be with me if I'm helpful, not if I'm not, you know? Mm-hmm. And so the risk always feels like to me, if there's a project that I can't quite get my hands around, or if I'm not confident I know exactly what I'm doing, I tend to procrastinate because the danger there feels like I'm going to lose my belonging if I expose myself as somebody who doesn't know what they're doing. Mm. And sometimes it's enough for me to just remember, because consciously I don't believe that, right? It's like I know better, but my body's still learning the lesson. And so sometimes it's enough for me to just, it's almost like just preaching a little good news to myself. Mm-hmm. To be like, no, you are loved and your belonging doesn't hinge on the success of this project. Mm. And what if, and I think I learned this reframing from an Oliver Berkman book, what if this was just an interesting problem to work on?
Hmm.
Like, what if my work is just interesting problems? Like, what if the problems that I encounter in my work are interesting? And sometimes that's enough for me to just go, oh yeah, they are actually interesting.
Yeah.
And I can, if I engage them as interesting, then somehow the threat level is decreased. It's like, oh, of course I don't know what I'm doing. Like, that's part of the fun of being a human, is learning. And so I can just learn. And this is just an interesting problem that I don't know what to do about yet, but I'm going to spend some time working on it by thinking about it. There's no threat there. That's fine. It's fun, actually. Sometimes that's enough for me. Just reframe it.
Yeah.
Sometimes I got to do some more healing. But
yeah, I feel like reframing is good when I can get there. Mm-hmm. But sometimes I can't get there. Meaning, I don't know. Like, there's some processing involved there, right, Ben?
Right.
And so sometimes it's helpful for me just to name, I'm feeling threatened by sending this email. Mm. I'm scared.
Yeah.
And really this is some of the connection and safety that Susan's talking about. Like, I'm essentially just offering it to myself.
Mm. Yeah. And I think sometimes we can do it on ourselves and not moralize it, not make it bad or good, but just be compassionately curious about it. But if we have a faithful, trusted, safe friend, sometimes they can help us do that as well. Like, I'm hearing Ben do that right now for you, Matt. I think I just recently had a friend, I was explaining a situation. And I was like, I don't know why I feel so anxious about this. And I even said that to her. Yeah. And she goes, I know why you're feeling anxious about it, because the last time this happened in your life was X amount of years ago, and this is what went down. And I was like, oh, I didn't even think about that. But my body was holding it. The memories were there. And she was able to help reframe that the situation currently is very different than it was, you know? So sometimes people help that.
Yeah,
for sure. Yeah, and I think that's what part of what Susan was talking about. That's the part of the help. I mean, this has been the humbling lesson for me in learning to kind of like be a spiritual director for people, is that most of the good I do is just is just listening. Most of the good I do is just being a resonating witness. Mm-hmm. Just being somebody who can hear you say this thing that maybe you're a little ashamed of, or maybe you're scared to admit, or you just realized. And just to be somebody who is not shocked by that, to be somebody who doesn't immediately tell you to fix that, or you should probably never say that again, you know, or you know, whatever else, all the internal scripts that run for us. Like, a lot of times it does, the embodied witness is like maybe 95% of the work sometimes. Just have somebody bear witness to it and say, yeah, I get it.
Yeah. Well, this whole conversation reminds me of a joke.
Thank you for preempting it and just telling us that you're going to say a joke. I appreciate my anxiety level just went down, Matt.
I think it has
co-regulation.
It has something to do with
co-regulation. It's
with
happening.
Me being connected to you, Christy.
I appreciate that. Tell us your joke, Matt. So
and
sweet.
I just
want to hear it.
I just want to point out to the listener, I've already been thanked for telling a joke today, so it doesn't matter how good the joke is. Christy, what has 4 legs and flies?
I don't know. What has 4 legs and flies?
A dead horse.
What? I don't get it.
Because it's decaying.
Oh, that's gross.
Yeah. Okay, then?
It's the cycle of life. It's the circle. It's the circle.
Let me say, what's funnier than a dead horse?
A flying horse?
A dead horse in a clown costume. What's funnier than a dead horse in a clown costume?
I don't know. What is it?
A dead horse in a clown costume on fire flying through the sky. What's funnier than a dead...
Yes.
What's funnier than a dead horse in a clown costume?
In a clown costume?
On fire flying through the sky.
I don't know, but please tell me.
A dead clown in a horse costume flying through the sky on fire.
Oh my gosh.
See?
This feels like a 5-year-old like started telling jokes and then got in too deep and was like, I don't know where the punchline is.
Add a zero to that.
That sounds funny.
Add a zero to the 5-year-old, and that's what you got here. All right. What's funnier than a dead clown in a horse costume on fire flying through the sky?
I don't know, but I bet you're in tell me.
Stopping it with a shovel. Dong.
Your guys' faces, I like look at your faces to like help get some clues about when I'm supposed to laugh.
I'm with you on this one, Christy. I just don't get it.
I'm not sure.
I feel like it's going to go somewhere. It's not.
Dead clown.
Dead clown who?
All right. Well, sometimes jokes just write themselves and sometimes they don't. And when they don't, it's sometimes better off to leave them unfinished.
Mm. Okay. Well, then in that case, friends, thanks for listening to our podcast. Yep.
So sorry.
See you next time.
Thank you for joining us for this episode of the Gravity Podcast. If you're finding it helpful, please tell your friends about it. Word of mouth is the best advertising. Ratings and reviews online also help others find the podcast. And don't forget to subscribe so you don't miss an episode. To join discussions about the podcast and lots more, join us in the Gravity community. It's free to join, and you can connect there with other listeners to the podcast to talk about faith and spirituality and whatever else comes up. To join, go to gravitycommons.com/community. The Gravity Podcast is produced by Ben Sternke and Matt Tebbe. Aaron Sternke edits and mixes the podcast. You can check out his mixing, engineering, and production work at aaronsternke.com. Finally, we would love to hear from you. To record a question or comment for us, you can go to gravitycommons.com/message and click the start recording button. You can also email us at podcast@gravitycommons.com. Catch you next time.